Hello, everybody. Welcome to Book Talk from the Scottish Book Trust. I'm Ryan Van Winkle, your host for this episode. And today, because it's the summertime, and I'm sure some of you are out on the road and traveling, we wanted to dedicate an entire podcast to just moving around the world. So we're going to take a little trip with you guys. We're going to go to Roman Britain. We're going to go and visit the River Nile and explore Egypt. And we're going to go to the Middle East as well. So it's going to be a jam-packed world tour of a podcast, and we're really excited about it. First up on the episode today, we've got Charlotte Higgins. She's talking about a book called Under Another Sky, Journeys in Roman Britain. We met up with her at the Mitchell Library as part of the I Write Festival. Here she is talking about the Roman side of the British Isles, Charlotte Higgins.
My name's Charlotte Higgins, and I'm author of a book called Under Another Sky, Journeys in Roman Britain. So it's about Roman Britain, that's for a start, but it's about the idea of Roman Britain. It's about how the idea of Roman Britain has resonated in British culture, I suppose, since the end of Roman rule, from the time that Roman ideas, remains and texts started to be rediscovered, which begins to happen in the medieval period in a sort of folkloric way and in a much more systematic historiographical way from the 16th century onwards. But it's also a travelogue, so it's about place. So I set out in the tradition of a lot of the 18th century antiquaries who are very keen on going on journeys around Britain, discovering its antique remains. I do that, but in a blue VW camper van instead of a horse and carriage. And so it's about thinking about Britain's history and landscape through this funnel of Romanness.
Did you just go and find where little bits of ruins and was? Because I know everywhere around there's these just little nods towards what kind of was there, and this is, can oftentimes be very, very small. Was that it? And was it fun to do? Sounds like it would be a great road trip.
It was a really great road trip, and you're right to suggest that, you know, most great number of British Roman ruins are what they would call unspectacular. You have to admit, they're largely unspectacular. Okay, there are some amazing remains in Roman Britain. So the remains of Roman Bath in Somerset are amazing. Hadrian's Wall is amazing. Here in Scotland, there are some really extraordinary things that perhaps aren't as well known about as they could be, but there are some really good parts of the Antonine Wall, which, as I'm sure you listeners know, was the wall built in 142 AD by Antoninus Pius between the Firths of Forth and Clyde. It's not spectacular like Hadrian's Wall because it was never built in masonry, so you don't get this physical masonry wall. What you do get is a ditch and a mound made in turf, but often in very dramatic landscape. That is where it is not running through or beneath the canal, the railway line, the A82, etc., etc. It's much more built up than Hadrian's Wall. But also there are lovely things in Perthshire. There's a beautiful fort called Inardock up on the Gask Ridge. So there are wonderful things to investigate and see. There's a lovely set of bathhouses in Bear's Den. But yeah, it was a journey of discovery because I didn't know a whole lot of these remains. We just set forth, me and my boyfriend, and discovered all kinds of parts of the country actually that I didn't know, just seeing everything through the filter of these Roman remains. And a lot of the time, yeah, they are sort of more extraordinary than you might expect. If you're ever in Norfolk, I mean, there's the most spectacular coastal fort just by Great Yarmouth, which really has that kind of hefty feel of a terrifying military installation. The walls are still 20 foot tall. It's a huge, huge thing. In Cumbria, there's the most heart-stoppingly beautiful fort right up on a mountain pass in Eskdale, on Hardknot Castle, it's called. There are wonderful things to see, and it was two summers of sort of blissful pottering around, kind of looking at low stone rubbly walls going, that's very interesting.
The thing that always strikes me about this is, and it's the thing that I could never get around my head as a child or as a teenager, when my parents would take me to go to see some of these landmarks, where you're like, oh, it's a rock, you know? But then once you start putting your own imagination and your research to work, everything changes, doesn't it?
What really excited me was that it's possible for us now to have an encounter with these physical remains, but also we are, you know, coming ahead of us are dozens and dozens of encounters through history. So the idea of Britain's Romanness meant very different things at very different times. You know, sometimes there's a sense in the 18th century, there is some wonderful antiquarian writing where it really means something about the rise and fall of empires. You know, there's a kind of built into thinking about these Roman remains is the sense that this was a really extraordinary empire that ruled most of the known world, and it collapsed. And that's what happens to empires. So you get these very sort of strong ideas pumping through these remains. I mean, I was also, I mean, aside from the whole task and joy of looking at the remains, I was also spending a lot of time in the library, absorbing, writing about Roman Britain, thinking about how it had been thought about in the past, quite often as a sort of generative thing for artists and writers of fiction and composers and poets. So there's tremendous, you know, there's wonderful Houseman, Auden, Wilfred Owen. So there was a lot to discover. Hardy wrote a beautiful short story about an antiquary who is excavating at Maiden Castle, which is down in sort of Hardy country, needless to say, just outside Dorchester. So there was a lot to discover about the way people had thought and reimagined and used Roman Britain as a kind of imaginative force.
How has your perception of Britain changed through this kind of project and doing this? Has it had a shift? Has it had an impact on your thinking about what Britain is and was?
Yeah, I think it definitely has. I mean, first, I was trained as a classicist, okay, so I went to university and studied Latin and Greek. I thought quite a lot about the Roman Empire for a few years. I suppose I'd never really brought that thinking home to Britain. I'd always thought about it in a sort of pan-imperial way or in relation to, you know, whatever texts I happened to be studying. Roman Britain always seemed that bit too close to home and a bit unglamorous, you know, a bit sort of dreary and a bit damp and not consisting of good food and wine in the way that Italy and Greece so clearly do. But actually, if you really kind of cast your gaze on Roman Britain, it's a really long period in British history, which is hardly thought about now. It's for 400 years. So Britain as part of the Roman Empire is still longer than the time that separates us from Shakespeare's birth. So that is a really massive part of history. And I think in itself, it's quite telling that we slightly edit it out of our thinking about nationhood and history. Certainly in England, the prevailing kind of subconscious identity myth is Anglo-Saxon. The idea of Roman Britain complicates ideas about borders and about nationhood. It complicates ideas about multiculturalism, frankly. I mean, Roman Britain was a very mixed place. There were Syrians on Hadrian's Wall. The mouth of the River Tyne was, ironically, as it turns out, guarded by people from Basra in Iraq. In Scotland, there were people from the Middle East and Greece. That can be rather a complicating shock for people who prefer to imagine an early history for Britain that is very white.
Yeah, and it's speaking of mythologies, my impression of the Romans has always been this sort of, I guess this reductive kind of notion that the Romans came and they made it as far as Hadrian's Wall, and then the Scots beat them back, and that's the end of the Roman Empire in the UK, right? Like, that's a really dumb interpretation of it, but that's the sort of the received impression of it.
That's true, and it's not exactly dumb. Don't be too hard on yourself. That is a received wisdom for good reason, because clearly it's an important conscious or unconscious part of the idea of Scottishness that the Romans never civilised you lot. You know, you were tough and managed to keep them at bay. I mean, the truth, of course, is always a bit more complicated than the mythology. But there were 18th century antiquaries in Scotland who were very invested in the idea that they were never fully civilised by the Romans and therefore never softened and never made decadent. And all these ideas about history are very active in all kinds of, you know, later subsequent periods. But yeah, the truth is more complicated. And for anyone who wants to discover a bit more about Romanness in Scotland, first port of call would absolutely be the National Museum of Scotland, which has got a really extraordinary Roman collection. And when you see where the Roman stuff was found, it's pretty extraordinary. I mean, there are things from, you know, up near Elgin. There are things from the Orkneys. Okay, so Romans weren't there in the Orkneys, probably, although the Romans did claim to have circumnavigated Britain. But what finding bits of Roman glass in the Orkneys tells you that there was Roman contact, that there was a dynamic relationship between people all over the British Isles and the Romans.
Charlotte Higgins, everybody. Under Another Sky, Journeys in Roman Britain is the name of the book. You can find it at fine bookstores and internets everywhere. Charlotte Higgins, if you want to find out more about her and keep track of where she's going and where she's reading and what she's doing and other journalistic endeavors that she's embarking upon, you can follow her on Twitter at Chiggy, C-H-I-G-G-I. And of course, speaking of Twitter, if you want to keep up with the Scottish Book Trust and what we're doing, all sorts of news and information going out on all our social media feeds, follow us on Twitter at Scottish BK Trust. Like us on the old Facebook by just clicking the like button, or of course, go visit our website at scottishbooktrust.com. There you'll find all sorts of news, events, resources for your reading life. Next up, we're going to ride down the River Nile with Robert Twigger. Robert Twigger is a fantastic writer, a really interesting guy, and he's written the biography of the world's greatest river.
I'm Robert Twigger, and this book is called Red Nile, and it's a biography of the River Nile.
How do you face a biography of an inanimate object?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a con. I've always believed, you know, rivers have life. I mean, and if you spend a lot of time on rivers, I'd previously spent 3 summers canoeing a long Canadian river, and I really felt it had a kind of moral quality that was different to other rivers I went on. So from there, it's kind of a short step to thinking of a river as a living thing and therefore deserving of a biography. And I was living in Egypt, so I wanted to write about the Nile, but in an all-encompassing kind of polymathic way, rather than just a sort of straight history.
But that's massive, because it goes from the beginning until now. How do you decide in that kind of context what it is you're going to include in terms of the life of this river?
Well, that was really the hardest thing. So I kicked that around. In fact, I did do one proposal, and the editor kicked it back and said, "Will you put everything into this? You know, is this going to be a history of the world?" So at that time, I was living in Cairo. It was the time of the first Arab Spring kind of rebellion. And my wife, this is a very strange coincidence, was editing various, she's an internet journalist, various instances of hate on the internet. And one was a guy who talked about rivers of blood, which is a quote from an Enoch Powell speech in England, but this was in Arabic. So I thought, blood, yes, Red Nile. And it all fell into place, because we've got the White Nile, the Blue Nile. Why not the Red Nile, which would then be a selection, a heuristic, if you like, for, you know, the bloodiest stories, the most passionate stories. And so that way I kind of immediately knew what I needed to put in the book.
Would you mind giving us some of these stories, some of the ones that you thought, oh yeah, this is what have made this river distinct, say, from the Mississippi, that have made it distinct from the river you were canoeing on in, say, Canada?
The obvious one is it's the only river that crosses the Sahara. It's the only river that connects sub-Saharan Africa with Northern Africa, with the Mediterranean. So it becomes like the conduit, the mains cable for slavery, for ivory. You know, initially this is a kind of commercial reason for the existence of the Nile, or it's what we derive from the Nile. So they're just like endless stories, but one of the comes to mind is the Caliph Hakim. Hakim was this mad caliph in the Islamic period, and sort of around about sort of 1200 or 1300, and he just hated dogs barking, so he asked for all the dogs of Cairo to be killed, which they were. And he didn't like seeing people working and going about their business during the day. He liked to walk around without anyone there, so he made people work at night, which they did, and actually they're still doing it. He was an absolutely madman, really. He put to death all kinds of members of the opposition. He was the first guy who wanted to dam the Nile, and he sent an Islamic polymath called Ibn Haytham, who later was the first guy to build a camera obscura, but he sent him to build a dam across the Nile. Ibn Haytham realized he couldn't, but he would be killed for failing to do that. So he feigned madness for 12 years. And after 12 years, Hakim had died, so Ibn Haytham was able to escape with his life.
It's interesting you say, you know, they're still working at night to this day.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, are there instances in going through this, have you seen the ways that the life of the river, in terms of, you know, when it rises, when it falls, when it creates, when it goes dry, I guess, you know, where those things have had profound effects, not only in Egypt, but throughout the world?
Yeah, I mean, the big difference between since this sort of late 60s is that the Nile flood stops at the top end of Egypt at the Aswan Dam. So you don't get that sort of, the water rises, the Nile does rise, but now you have year-round irrigation, so that's allowed far more agriculture. So it has changed, a huge increase in population as a result of that. But people still live alongside the Nile as they have always lived, so growing the same things that they've grown, and still even ceremonies that they're still performed. I mean, when a child is born, he's kind of put in a sieve. I mean, it sounds like a weird idea, and kind of tossed in the sieve for good luck, but that was an ancient pharaonic ceremony that's still being performed even in a predominantly Muslim country.
Those floods that happened, those had a profound effect on people's lives, and that happened over hundreds of years, right? Yeah. And they settled into a routine. And are some of those routines still seen today beyond?
Yeah, I think that you're right. They're in sort of strange kind of ways, like apparently during the flood, people had to work incredibly hard during the flood period to make the most of it. So Egyptians would typically eat their food cold in the fields. And one other thing I've really noticed about Egyptians is they're not bothered by cold food. My wife is Egyptian, so, you know, often we're eating cold food. You know, it was made 2 hours ago, and I'm saying, why are we eating it cold? But there's this sort of, I always think it's like a, kind of like a race memory of eating it in the fields because they've got to finish their job.
The book is called The Red Nile. It's a biography of the world's greatest river by Robert Twigger. The world's greatest, what makes it the world's greatest river?
My publishers.
Do you not believe that it is the greatest river?
Well, I mean, it is in terms of history. I mean, it really is. It's, we've got everything in this book. We've got ancient Egypt. We've got Moses. We've got Jesus escaping down the Nile. We've got, you know, the Crusades. It's got Napoleon, because Napoleon turns up and tries to conquer Egypt. So we've got every bit of history. You know, World War II, we've got, you know, to the Arab Spring. So it's a kind of mains cable of history. So in that sense, it really is.
As you were looking at it and living, I guess, through the Arab Spring, were there connections that were surprising to you? Were there connections between the life of the river and the kind of revolution that was happening on the streets of Cairo and stuff that were remarkable?
In a way, one of the things which is sort of a problem in Egypt is that the Nile is underutilized in Cairo. It's used for water. The only people who live on the Nile still are fishermen, and they still propel themselves around in boats, and they live on these boats in the center of Cairo. And I often, and they live by catching fish, and those boats are the same shape as boats that were depicted on friezes that are 4,000 years old. Same shape boats, which is incredible. And I often used to think, during all this rebellion that was going on at Tahrir Square, you know, they were still rowing up and down, and kind of they're still there. So in a way, this rebellion was maybe transient. Maybe this life of the river is something that's continuing and will continue.
Yeah, or in the grand scope of things, yeah, there's ups and downs, upheavals, yeah, you know, floods and droughts, I guess.
Yeah. Definitely.
It's a way to perceive time and human existence in a way. Yeah. Did it break your head looking at all of this stuff?
I think my eyes are worse. We're just talking about eyesight. I've read a lot of books reading this, doing this thing. In general, what you find when you research something like this is you just generate all these connections. For example, just a trivial one is I didn't realize that Herod, who obviously tried to kill all the young babies and kill Jesus, Jesus goes to Egypt to escape, but Herod had earlier in his life had a long love affair with Cleopatra. So then we've got a quite great connection there between Jesus and Julius Caesar, which is really weird.
Robert Twigger, everybody. The book is called Red Nile, a biography of the world's greatest river. Do get yourself a copy. If you want to find out more about Robert Twigger, find out where he's reading and signing books, you can look him up on roberttwigger.com. Lastly, we're going to talk about two anthologies of contemporary poetry from the Middle East. The first one I want to bring up is called A Bird Is Not a Stone. It features new Palestinian poetry with Scottish translations. Loads of Scottish authors are involved in this project, including Liz Lockhead, Jackie Kay, Kathleen Jamie. You do definitely want to check out this book. They just had two launches in Scotland, and we were really pleased to catch up with Liz Niven at one of the launches. Here she is talking about the translation she worked on, the poet Liz Niven. Liz, can you tell us a little bit about the poem you chose to translate and you'll be reading a bit of here?
Okay, I chose a couple of different poems, and this one here is called Abu Hayyan in his Ain Hon Scriven. I translated it into Scots, a kind of light Scots, and the bridge translation is by Jonah Fraz from an original poem, Yusuf al-Mahmud, and so it goes like this. What's up with me if I walk a wee bit or a lot? My steps are gan, heels are gowdy, hour me. What's up with me? I'm the encircling sea. My stern is betraying me, and my horns are scudding me. What's wrang with me? I'm all pictured, and the doors are shutting without me, and the yin that's mine has been ta'en by somebody else. Thon time, the bird o' Miss Hunter was screeching abin my head. Since the sons o' God dons it, I've been the morn o' my youth. My greeting heart has been riven apart. I've been the stains. What's wrang with me then? And I'm the ocean. I am the ocean. And the wee grain of sun is no me.
Thanks, Liz. That was great. Is there? How did it feel? Because you didn't get a chance to meet the poet themselves. You don't speak Arabic, correct?
No, I don't.
And so you were working off a bridge translation, and then trying to inhabit somebody else's life, experience, feelings, and emotions. How did that feel to try to do that at this distance as well?
Well, I suppose quite a lot of poetry you do have to read at a distance from the poet. So from that point of view, it's not unusual. Often the person is not there. But you certainly do inhabit another world reading the British translations of a Palestinian poet. The world that we were entering for the vast majority of the poems were very rich and deep and concerning themselves with quite substantially distressing situations. And so I felt we were privileged really to enter this country and its issues through this kind of method of looking at their poetry, reading the British translations, and then deciding which language we would put it into. In my case, it was Scots.
Did you do all your translations into Scots?
I did, actually. In fact, yes, I did. I chose Scots for all of them. Some of the same poems appear in English versions as well, which is always interesting. But no, I chose Scots, both for the rhythm of it, putting it into a Scottish music rather than a Palestinian or Arabic music, which probably shifts the music of it quite a lot. But also I think it's always refreshing to read work in Scots, which emanates from another country and another language. There's something really interesting about this little country in the north edge of Europe, finding itself with a good enough voice to speak for other poets.
Thanks, Liz, and thanks to everybody involved in the Bird Is Not a Stone project. As I said, there are very many Scottish poets involved in this book. It's a huge anthology, and it has a great resource online as well as in its physical edition. You can have a look for it online at abirdisnotastone.wordpress.com. And of course, you can buy a copy of the book at bookshops everywhere, and is, of course, available online from Freight Publishing. Freight Publishing also released a book called The Room is Waiting, and this features contemporary poetry from Iraq. It was a project I was involved in as part of Real Festivals, and it was a great joy to be there and do it. I really hope that people get a chance to check this out. The book is called This Room is Waiting, and here's a little excerpt from a conversation that we had with the Scottish poet William Letford and the Iraqi Kurdish poet Awizan Nouri. Billy had worked on some of Awizan's poems for this collection, so you'll hear a little bit of what's in this anthology called This Room is Waiting.
Awizan Nouri.
Before we ask any questions, maybe we should start off with one of your poems. So maybe you'd like to read one for us in Kurdish.
Kharika kalda chmoa. Okatani gulak kharika dakhinche, sozi baran lekhuya. Galayak kharika damre, amizi bahayak lekhuya. Jnek kharika dakurje, sharafi piyavik lekhuya.
Thank you very much. And let's hear this in English via our friend William Letford.
Feeding. When a flower dies, where is the passion of rain? When a leaf dies, where is the embrace of the wind? When a woman is killed for honour, where is the dignity of man? When a flag is burned, where is the conscience of a country?
That's a very powerful poem. Would you call that a political poem?
It's political, and it's also about life as in general.
Is it a kind of poem that is difficult to read, or does it come from your background? Because I know you're also an activist and you do a lot with women's rights in Kurdistan. Does it come from your personal experience as an activist?
Yeah, she said that she works as an activist for women's rights, and these stories do affect her work. When a woman gets killed for her honour, you know, it's really difficult, and so these things do affect her work. You know, in the situation that's happening in Iraq at the moment, when a child dies or when its parents die, the government isn't looking after the people in the same way that in the poem it says that when a leaf is dying, where is the wind to look after the leaf when it's falling, to comfort it as it's falling?
That's a really interesting image. Is it difficult to write about these things, or is it essential and important? Do you have to force yourself to write about them, or does it come very naturally?
She said it's, you know, in the situation it's difficult, and instead of crying and shouting and getting angry about it, the way that she releases that is by writing poetry.
I am descended from sunflowers. When I face you, I bloom. Please, don't sit on me.
Now, really, there's an interesting little story about this, and maybe explains a little bit about the nature of our sort of translation experience with real festivals.
Hu Shang was helping me translate it, and he was working with me in Awazan, and Hu Shang was, he really liked the poem, so he was very enthusiastic when he was telling me the poem, and when he said it, he said, "Please, don't sit on me." And because of a discrepancy and that, just that one vowel in the word sit, I thought it said sit when he had actually said set. So in Awazan's original poem, it is "please don't sit on me," but when I translated it, I put it as "please don't sit on me," and I thought it was so good, the image of the flower being crushed by someone sitting on it. I really enjoyed that, and it was only when we were rehearsing an event in Iraq that we realised that I had translated it wrongly. But after speaking to Awazan, she said it would be okay for serendipity to leave it in there.
Do you like it that way, yeah?
Yes.
Will you change your original version?
لا بقي بس المعنى هو جاي نفس المعنى فما عندي مشكلة بس هوشانغ كان شديد ويانا ونفس الكلمة لازم نفس الكلمة يا معود يا نفس الكلمة مو لا أريد أنزلك قصيدة.
She said she's not going to change her original poem, but she likes Billy's translation, and she said it has the same meaning in the end. But she said, but Hoshang was so determined, he was like, "You have to use the same word," and she was like, "No, we can use the same meaning, it's fine."
Have you done much translating of other people's work and your own work into other languages, Awazan?
She said that she hasn't, she's worked before in her own country with Arabs, because she's Kurdish, so she's like translated from Kurdish into Arabic, but never with people from Europe. And she said this was the first time that she's had to translate into a European language, and it was a big success, and she really enjoyed it. And even before we started Real Iraq, she was kind of thinking, how am I gonna get the meaning across to them, and how will they use these beautiful words that we have, and you know, how's that gonna all work? And she's really intrigued by that.
I was on Nuri, everybody, along with William Letford. Thanks to both of them for taking part in this project. The book is called This Room is Waiting. It features contemporary poetry from Iraq. We hope you enjoyed your world tour in books. We hope wherever you're going this summer, you definitely make sure to take sun cream with you and a really, really good paperback. Don't bring a hardback. They're too heavy and you don't want to pay the excess fees on the EasyJet flights to wherever you're going. Sit on the beach, sit by the pool. Go hill walking, go camping, but bring a book with you wherever you are. They are the most portable and enjoyable things you can have with you at any given time this summer. You'll never be bored on your summer holiday if you have a good book with you. Thanks again to the authors who appeared on this podcast. That's Charlotte Higgins, Robert Twigger, Liz Niven, William Letford, and Awazan Nuri. It's been a pleasure being in your ears. And of course, no matter where you're traveling this summer, if you're just staying at home and reading a book, or if you're going far, far away from home, safe travels, literally and metaphorically.